Today's sermon has a lighthearted title, Guy Talk. But the subject, to many people, is very important. One of the problems the church has finally confronted over the past few decades is the patriarchal language that has dominated Western religious life for thousands of years. By patriarchal language, I mean male language. There are many people who do not feel patriarchal language is a problem. For example, lots of people are quite comfortable always referring to God as He and always labeling humanity as mankind. But it has been pointed out that for many women, especially women who grew up with cruel and abusive fathers, the language we use tends to build a wall between them and God and hinders them as they seek to establish a relationship with God. And for all of us, using male terms to speak of God gives God certain characteristics that undoubtedly have nothing to do with the eternal spirit which is calling creation into being. Since most people in the world today who give the idea of monotheism honest consideration do not think God has gender, it might seem a good idea to eliminate the use of predominantly male language when referring to the Creator. But as with all noble ideas, this one has its good points and its bad points. While I believe we should avoid patriarchal language whenever possible, there is a danger in taking the idea too far. We lose some important parts of our heritage and some important and useful theological concepts. I guess the first question we have to ask is, where did this idea of God being a male come from in the first place? I mean, there's no need for God to have gender. God does not need to reproduce. But long ago, the human race, in its attempt to come to grips with the mystery of life and the endless questions produced by a world that is so often cruel and unpredictable, quite naturally conceived of a god or gods that were somehow in control, somehow responsible for the unexplained. And since the most powerful living beings were men, male human beings, it was quite natural to envision the gods, or at least the most powerful of the gods, as being a male also. If you look to the early mythological traditions, Greek, Roman, Norse, the most powerful god was always male. When we read the Old Testament, we discover some interesting things about Yahweh, the God of the Old Testament. First of all, he was male. But second, and of great interest to those of us who study the evolution of human thought with regard to religion, Yahweh was not alone. In large parts of the Old Testament writings, Yahweh is the most powerful God, the God of a chosen people, the Jews. But he's not the only God. This idea is so offensive to many religious people, they refuse to see it, even though it's obvious to anyone who approaches the Bible with honesty and integrity. In the first creation myth of Genesis, we find the line, "Let us make man in our image." Who is God talking to? Later Christian apologists claim this was a case of the Father speaking to the Son and the Holy Spirit. And it is fine for us to think of the story that way, but it certainly wasn't the way the person who wrote the story was thinking. At the very least, the author envisioned God speaking with other, although lesser, spiritual realities, if not with other actual gods. In the Old Testament, the gods are always attached to a particular geographical area. Yahweh, the most powerful God and the God of the Jews, was the God of Israel. In the book of Judges, when the Jews are fighting over that land, the Jewish warrior, Jephthah, sends a message to the Ammonite king. In it, he tells that king that Yahweh allowed the Hebrews to conquer this land once occupied by the Amorites. So the land now belongs to Yahweh and the Jews. The king of the Ammonites, Jephthah says, should at once vacate this land and go back to the land controlled by their god, Chemosh, the god of the Moabites and the Ammonites. These were basically male warrior gods, and their power was usually limited to the geographical area over which they had control. If you honestly study the Old Testament, you discover that the idea of one God over all of creation did not enter the Hebrew mentality until the time of the Babylonian exile. That is when the theology of the Jews came face to face with a serious problem. If Yahweh was the greatest God, and if the Jews were Yahweh's chosen people, how was it that all of Israel's neighbors kept kicking Israel around like some puny little kid? And then the ultimate insult, King Nebuchadnezzar and his troops march into Jerusalem in 587 BC. They leveled Jerusalem, destroyed the temple, and took the Hebrew people away to Babylon as captives. As the Hebrew priests and prophets sat exiled in Babylon and dreamed of their homeland, the idea of a God who was not limited by time and space, a God not bound to a particular parcel of land, entered the Jewish imagination. This God was everywhere, and wherever there were Hebrew people, and importantly, Hebrew writings, the Torah, Yahweh was a real and living presence. This was the birth of true monotheism, and many scholars believe the oldest biblical writing that reflects true monotheism is found in chapters 40 to 55 of the book of Isaiah. Those chapters of the book of Isaiah are believed to have been written by a Jewish prophet during the Babylonian captivity. And this was the start of something wonderful. The human mind had evolved to the point it was able to start conceiving of a single God, a spiritual reality which gives rise to all of creation. Before I move on, I should mention, for those of you who have an interest in the Old Testament, that the fifth book of the Bible, Deuteronomy, is a re-envisioning of the story of the Hebrew people, which attempts to explain how it is that Yahweh's chosen people keep getting kicked around by their neighbors. A new theology is developed in that book. To make a long story short and simple, the theme of Deuteronomy is that Israel is indeed the chosen people of Yahweh, but Yahweh punishes Israel for its sins and its disobedience to Yahweh by allowing other nations to conquer the land. That theme, which is called the Deuteronomistic history, dominates many books of the Old Testament. Back to this breakthrough in our thinking, this idea of one God in all of creation. We human beings still insisted on finding a way to turn this single God into a male. This one God over all creation was sometimes viewed as a capricious, iron-fisted tyrant who looked down from beyond the dome of the sky, and he was sometimes viewed as a benevolent and caring daddy in the sky. But in both instances, God was male, and the idea that God is somehow a reflection of human men has persisted throughout the ages. Ironically, it was the attempts of modern human beings to dismiss the idea of God that recaptured much of the original attempts to conceive of God honestly. When Enlightenment thinkers put an end to any hope of ever finding that man-like God peering down at us from the heavens, we were forced to expand our thinking. And we rediscovered the truth that some of those ancient Hebrew prophets tried to embrace. The same truth that the Apostle Paul expressed when he said, "It is in God that we live and move and have our being." Or as Jesus said, "God is spirit, and we should worship God in spirit and in truth." The real God has always been here. We just can't seem to get over our obsession with dressing God up like a man. Even Enlightenment theologians still used male language for God, assuming people would understand that this was simply a metaphor and should not be taken too seriously. But using only male language in reference to God seems a little dishonest. And as I mentioned earlier, over the last third of the 20th century, many theologians and ministers started making an attempt to avoid patriarchal language. While there are lots of good reasons for not thinking of God in male terms, it certainly causes us a lot of problems. For example, what do we do with all those beautiful hymns we find in our pilgrim hymnal? Do we just quit singing those songs since they refer to God as He? And along with the music, what do we do with 2,000 years of Christian theology? Do we just toss it aside because we no longer like parts of the language? Let me give you a few examples, real-life examples, of how this affected my seminary experience. I love spiritual writing, but at seminary, I was not introduced to Thomas Merton, who, in my opinion, is the greatest of the modern Christian mystics. I was later told it was because of Merton's patriarchal language. He wrote in the middle years of the 20th century, before all that male language became taboo. And while it was considered imperative to a good theological education that seminary students learn all about the great theologians of history, Augustine, Aquinas, Luther, Barth, and so on, the more modern writers tended to be ignored if they used language that was not inclusive. Of course, anybody who has ever read Thomas Merton knows he did not think God was in any way male. Nevertheless, he used the word He, so his work was ignored. The second experience I had at seminary that made me realize we may be going too far with some of this language business happened when I was asked to say grace before our weekly community meal. I was scared to death. All the professors were there. We had lots of visitors, many of them seasoned preachers. And here I was, a first semester seminary student, being asked to do something I was quite uncomfortable with, offering an extemporaneous prayer in front of a large group. I kept it short, but at some point in my two or three sentence prayer, I said something to this effect: "We are thankful for this opportunity to gather in fellowship." Afterwards, I was berated by some of the female students for using the word fellowship. "Just another example," they said, "of a man trying to maintain the old status quo by using patriarchal terms to exclude women from full participation in the faith." Fellowship, they insisted, was one of those words that needed to be tossed onto the scrap heap of history along with other offensive male terms such as brotherhood. Well, over the years I was at seminary, those women came to view me as one of the most open-minded and pro-female people they had ever known. But to this day, I have an ongoing battle with regard to the problem of male language and the church. You will very seldom hear either Bob or me in a sermon refer to God as He or Him. But sometimes it is almost unavoidable. We don't want to say something like, "God made the decision God's self that God must act." It's difficult to avoid the use of pronouns when referring to God. But what are the options? Instead of saying He, Him, and Himself, we can use the words it and itself. I won't do that because I believe we can enter into a relationship with the eternal, with the sacred, and I personally don't find it language conducive to relationship. I mean, I can have a relationship with a friend, but I can't have a relationship with a chair. My wife is laughing at me. She might argue about that. In the round of 64, the basketball tournament, I definitely have a relationship with the chair in front of the TV. But generally speaking, I don't find it language helpful when talking about God. The next option is to use female language. And honestly, I have no problem with that. In fact, for me, I envision God with what we would traditionally call female characteristics at least as much as if I view God as having traditional male characteristics. God, the loving nurturer, is probably a more useful image than God, the stern disciplinarian. But if one uses only female language to describe God and refers to God only with female pronouns, she, her, herself, we've done the same injustice to the eternal spirit that we did when we used only male language. One answer is to use both types of language. In my personal prayer, I tend to do this, and I think it is helpful for me. But early in my ministry, I tried using female language from the pulpit, and it caused a problem. Nobody complained, and some people even said they appreciated it. But the problem was this. Once I said something like, God's love is absolute, and she will never stop loving us, I might as well have stopped talking, because nobody was going to hear the next few minutes. I could see people glaze over, and I could almost read their minds. Well, he referred to God as she. Well, that's all right. I mean, God isn't a sexual creature. God isn't a creature at all. There's certainly nothing wrong with using female language when talking about God. I think I heard some other preacher do that one time. By the time I got him back, the choir was singing the benediction response. So I gave up on mixing male and female language for God and make every effort to simply avoid using pronouns in my sermons when referring to him, her. You see the problem. My personal tastes are such that I enjoy the old hymns, and I have no problem singing those songs. But I do hope everybody realizes that we are embracing our Christian heritage when we sing those songs and not limiting God to some sort of male role. The real problem for me comes when we try to rewrite our history. For example, when we say the Lord's Prayer, we begin by saying, Our Father who art in heaven. For 2,000 years, this has been called the Lord's Prayer, and sometimes it is called the Our Father. As nearly as we can tell, that's the way Jesus said the prayer. And I don't think any person in history has been more in touch with the actual reality of God than Jesus. I don't believe any person who has ever lived has been more aware that God is not a male. I bring this up because some modern prayer books begin the Lord's Prayer with the words, Our Father / Mother, who art in heaven. But the prayer Jesus taught us to pray begins with the words, Our Father, and I think we should leave it alone. What we need here is education, not a reinvention of the prayer. I believe Jesus referred to God as Father, knowing full well that God is Spirit, because of the relational issues I mentioned earlier. Had Jesus called God it, or eternal spiritual reality, or sacred ground of being, people would not have understood him. First century Palestinian Jews would not have followed him. Likewise, if Jesus had referred to God in female terms, well, those listening would have been thrown off message even more than those who get hung up when I use female pronouns for God. Jesus used the term Father because the term is familiar and intimate, and at least when Jesus used it, conveys images of caring, protection, and affection. Does that mean we should always use the word Father when we refer to God? Absolutely not. But we should not run from the fact Jesus did use the term. His words are an important part of our history, and we can embrace his words and be informed by his message without allowing our thinking to be limited by his language. I hope I haven't sounded like a person who's in favor of patriarchal language, because I'm not. For example, I see no reason to continue our usage of the word mankind. Many religious people use it as a way of placing women beneath men on the cosmic hierarchy of being. These are the folks who prefer that second creation myth in Genesis. In the second myth, God creates a man, Adam, and parades a bunch of animals past him, hoping Adam finds a suitable helper. When Adam finds none that please him, God takes one of Adam's ribs and creates a woman. And this somehow is biblical proof that mankind, literally mankind, comes from God and woman comes from man. The story from the first chapter of Genesis says God created male and female human beings at the same time, and both were created in the image of God. And the proper translation of the Hebrew word for mankind from that first story is the word I prefer to use in place of mankind, humankind, or humanity. In my eyes, nothing is lost when we say humanity instead of mankind. As I close the message for this morning regarding patriarchal language, I want to give you a glimpse of next week's sermon, which is entitled The Kingdom of God. This is a phrase that is out of favor in most theologically liberal churches like ours. Not only does it conjure up images of God as a tyrant, a king — that tyrant is most certainly male, since he reigns over a kingdom. For me, however, I refuse to give up that phrase. In fact, I think those four little words, the kingdom of God, are the most important words in the entire Christian faith. Next week, I'll explain why.